11 o'clock, the Jeff Blair Show, in for Mr. Blair, whom you can hear from and see on Sportsnet. In an hour's time, Baseball Central, alongside Kevin Barker. Jeff Blair will have that. Sportsnet 590 fan again. You can watch it on Sportsnet. That's George Russick. I'm Jeff Sambit. So, one of the hottest teams in Major League Baseball is the Washington Nationals. Talk about them with their radio play-by-play voice, Charlie Sloes, in about 15 minutes or so. But you heard on Andrew Nye's update in the clip of Shai Davidi, who joined us to start the show at 9 o'clock, and talking about trade deadline deals. And it's worked out in some cases, and in a couple of cases, it certainly did not. And a great piece out of Sports Illustrated by Cliff Corcoran, which is no surprise because he's got many. And Cliff joins us on Sportsnet 590, The Fan. And Cliff, you look at a couple of blockbuster deals the Tigers and A's had made, the Tigers picking up David Price, the A's picking up John Lester, and you look at the subtractions that were made as a result of those trade from the big league roster, offensively speaking, and since then, those deals have not worked out for those two teams.
Yeah, it's only been a little while. It's been a couple weeks. It was 17. When I wrote the article, it was, I think, 17 and 16 games for the A's and Tigers, respectively. They put out that article, I think, was 2 days ago. Slumps can happen and things can happen over the short term. I'm kind of maybe overreacting to a short sample, but there's only so much of the season left. And if you look at what's going on with those two teams, you know, the thing that's most significant is that they're standing relative to playoff positions has changed since those deals for the worse. The Tigers fell out of first place in the Central, then fell out of the wild card spot. They're kind of going back and forth at the Mariners right now, but I think this morning they're a half game behind again. The A's tied with the Angels, falling back a half game behind at some point. I forget exactly where they are this morning. Yeah, they're a half game behind now, behind the Angels in the West. And they had a pretty commanding lead, and the Angels have been very good, but they've had the best record in baseball, the A's, most of the season. So they're falling back. So why? Both of those teams aren't scoring runs. And what did they just do? They both just traded one of their starting outfielders. And they have their slumps going on elsewhere on the team, but they got rid of a regular, reliable bat, and now they're in an offensive slump, and they're losing, and they're starting to slide relative to their playoff position. Meanwhile, the pitchers they acquired have made, you know, 3-4 starts each and have pitched pretty well, but the offensive slump has been more damaging than those pitchers to this point have been helpful. And those pitchers were acquired to help them get deeper into October, and their chances of getting into October for Detroit at all and for the Angels, for the A's getting, you know, not having to deal with that wild card game, not as much as it used to be. So you question whether or not they maybe gave up too much in those deals.
Cliff, you talk about struggles, and we'll talk about the Tigers first. J.D. Martinez turning back into J.D. Martinez, was that the absolute worst timing for Dave Dombrowski and the Tigers?
Well, that's exactly the thing, is they've got, you look at their outfield, and, you know, Torii Hunter has been up and down this season. He was very good in July. He's cooled back off in August, but I think he was pretty cold in June. A veteran player, not the player he used to be, certainly at the plate. And then elsewhere in the outfield, you've got J.D. Martinez and Rajai Davis. These are not guys who are full-time, everyday players. They're kind of, you know, J.D. Davis had a hot streak. Certainly they weren't wrong to ride it as long as they could, but their outfield was not necessarily so strong that they could get rid of Austin Jackson, who's been a reliable everyday center fielder for them and wasn't necessarily having a great season, but was hitting a little bit better than your average center fielder and doing it consistently for years for them. To think that they could get rid of that bat, having traded Prince Fielder in the offseason, you know, having Ian Kinsler being a first-half guy consistently in his career, falling off in the second half, and he's been ice cold for 2 months now. And their shortstop issue still being a problem because Suarez has not, you know, he's faded since his hot June. Castellanos at third base. They don't have this indomitable offense that you can get rid of a guy. but they did.
Well, and it's not just the offense as well, as you've highlighted beautifully in the piece. It's taking an integral part of your outfield out in looking at the Tigers with Austin Jackson being removed, because since then I've seen on a couple of occasions the Tigers making the highlight reels, and not for good things, for miscommunications in the outfield. And there's something to be said for that in doing something in a pennant race in mid-season, where you take somebody out that's a central figure of your defense out.
Yeah, there is something to that, absolutely. Davis, it's funny, in his career, Davis hits better in center field, but it's generally agreed that he's not quite really a full-time everyday center fielder defensively. He's better in left field. And so you've got Ezekiel Carrera, who really isn't much of a hitter, and, you know, they don't want to play him too much. And, yeah, it's not like they had some hot prospect or some fourth outfielder on the bench who was just, you know, pushing and forcing his way, please let me play center field. They didn't have that guy. You know, they gave up something that, now, look, Austin Jackson is not, you know, a superstar player, and he only had 1 year of team control left, and he's getting into his arbitration years, and you can understand maybe in the offseason where you move a guy like that if you have an opportunity to replace him, but not in the middle of a season where you've got a slight division lead, and you're looking at the postseason, and, you know, you're trading a key player. Like you say, he's been a central player on that team for years. A good center, not a great center fielder, but certainly a good center fielder, holds the fort down both at the plate and in the field.
Cliff, when I heard about the John Lester deal to the Oakland A's, I was shocked when I heard the name Yoenis Cespedes going back to the Red Sox and the other way. And Billy Beane and the A's obviously rolling the dice, taking a guy right out of the middle of their lineup to add a superstar lefty to their lineup. But did you share the same sentiments that, wow, they're getting that bat to bring in a guy like John Lester?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, even more so in the case of the A's, you know, Cespedes was, for a month and a half or so leading up to that trade, was their number three hitter. And, you know, Cespedes doesn't draw a lot of walks. His on-base percentage is low, but he's been hitting for a ton of power. And, you know, if you adjust for the ballpark, a very productive hitter. Not really superstar level. He's got the superstar strut, and he's got the superstar skills with his arm and his power and all that sort of thing. But he hasn't really been a superstar player, except for maybe a few months in his rookie season. But still, on that team, which is made up, again, of a lot of kind of best guy on your bench on another team types, you know, Steven Vogt or John Jaso or a lot of these guys who are getting playing time. You know, they traded for Johnny Gomes and Sam Fuld at the deadline to try to help replace Cespedes. And so they're working, and Bob Melvin has been brilliant at it, and that's why he, you know, was the manager of the year 2 years ago, and I think could have easily been last year and could easily be this year. You know, he's very good at mixing and matching those parts, but that's what they're doing. They're mixing and matching parts, and Cespedes was one of the few guys who was in that lineup every day, hitting in the middle of the order and producing for them. And that's the guy they traded. And now a bunch of these, you know, again, kind of journeyman, veteran, you know, fourth outfielder, the second catcher, et cetera, type guys, platoon guys, are going into slumps, and they don't have that rock in the middle of the order to keep the offense afloat, and they're losing.
With Cliff Corcoran of Sports Illustrated on the Jeff Blair Show, I'm Jeff Sammet. That's George Russick on Sportsnet 590. The Fan. Cliff, it's, you know, comparing apples and oranges. I realize that because teams' situations can differ. But we see with the Toronto Blue Jays in leading up to the deadline and seeing Lester go somewhere and seeing Price go somewhere. You know, a lot of Blue Jay fans felt, oh, why not us? Why didn't the Blue Jays go out and make that kind of a deal? And we heard Alex Anthopoulos leading up to that time say that he doesn't want to or have the depth to remove from the current roster, because it's kind of like robbing Peter to pay Paul. Do you look back at the Blue Jays situation, and not that they've been great in August, they've been horrible in August, as bad as anybody or worse than anybody in Major League Baseball, but do you look at that concept, that theory by Alex Anthopoulos at that time and say that the Blue Jays did the right thing in not making that kind of a move, assuming that they had the choice to?
Well, I think there's two things going on here. One is that, as I make the argument with the A's and the Tigers, trading a key piece from your 25-man roster to add another piece to that—that is, you know, paying
Robbing Peter to pay Paul.
Robbing Peter to pay Paul. I almost used that phrase in the piece and decided not to. Then I stumble over here. Anyway, that's something that I think has not worked for those two teams. And so the Blue Jays were smart if that was their only option to add a key piece was having to give up a key piece. The Blue Jays couldn't afford to do that and shouldn't have done that. I still think the Blue Jays should have made, they didn't make no moves. They got Danny Valencia, but that's not exciting anybody, and nor should it. Obviously everybody thinks they should have done something. They had plenty of need, certainly in the rotation and elsewhere, both due to injuries and just due to, a weak roster in places. They should have made a move, but, we also saw in a team that I left out of this article, the Cardinals made a trade, trading Joe Kelly and Alan Craig, trading pieces from their 25-man roster to get, same sort of thing. The reason I didn't include the Cardinals there is because Craig had been so bad all year that really it wasn't – he was already being outplayed by Oscar Tavares. They had that guy. They had that hotshot rookie that they could slot in, and Craig, again, was not a key player for them this year offensively. And otherwise, they traded a pitcher for a pitcher and whatever. So I didn't get into that. But, so we saw three teams have to deal major league pieces and legitimate starting players in order to make an upgrade. And if that was the price, things were going for, and you look around the league, Addison Russell getting traded to the Cubs, almost every deal that we saw was a very good deal for the team making the trade, with the possible exception of the David Price trade, where the Rays really didn't seem to get. But again, there, that was part of the three-way deal where the Tigers had to give up so much. The Rays didn't get the big major league player, but the Mariners did in that deal. There was very high prices going around this year, so maybe the Blue Jays just couldn't afford to pay it. And I believe that. I think that the Blue Jays needed to make a move, but it may not have been possible. It's not always possible for these teams to make a match. That's why the general managers get paid the money they do and why they're in the position they do, because they have to make those things happen, but it's not easy to do.
Cliff, though, to talk Blue Jay fans a little bit off the ledge when it comes to this lack of activity on the trade deadline, though, but generally speaking, these moves don't work out for a lot of these teams, do they?
Well, no. I mean, the fact is, and also everybody's getting smarter. There aren't any, saps out there in the league that you can take advantage of and say, it's called the trade because both teams are trying to get something valuable for themselves. And again, I think in prior to this year, the main way of doing things is, okay, I'll give you a really big prospect and you give me a really big major leaguer. And it was the difference was the interests and the time frames of the teams making the trade. So you see things like the Will Myers trade might be a decent example, although Myers was really major league ready when he was traded to the Rays. But if that's not the case anymore, if these teams don't have such differing interests, in part because of the extra wild card and the increased parity, where like the Red Sox, for example, say, okay, we'll trade a key piece. We've got John Lackey for league minimum option next year. We'll trade him, but you have to give us players that we can use to compete next year. If that's the going price, if that's the issue, then yeah, it's difficult to make those trades. The prices are higher than they used to be. It's tougher to get a deal done, and it's tougher to get a deal where one team is clearly going to win it.
Well, and in moving forward in seeing the evolution of a deal of this kind, do you think that if these deals don't work out, like if we see the Tigers and the A's continue to drop and not do as well as they did before the trade, do you think that we'll see deals a little less of deals where you do trade everyday players for pitchers?
Yeah, I do. I mean, one thing that it's interesting, I go back all the way back to maybe even the Indians of the 90s. I think about, they were one of the first teams under John Hart that started signing players to extensions prior to free agency. They did that almost entirely with hitters. Now, that Indians team was rich with hitters, and that's one reason. But, it's always been true that it's easier to predict the future performance of hitters than it is of pitchers. And, again, they're in the lineup every day. Now, a great pitcher, your Clayton Kershaws, your Felix Hernandezes, are going to be worth at least as much as a very good everyday hitter. I think that those guys should be in the MVP discussion more often than they are because of their value to their teams. But generally speaking, you know, an everyday player who you can count on, who you know what his level of production is going to be, who is less likely to suffer some sort of freak or catastrophic arm injury that could completely alter his career, and, you know, who's out there every day and making a difference, and particularly when we're talking about a fraction of the season, and I know the ratios are the same over the course of the season, 5 games to 1 or whatever, over a small part of the season where you're only going to get a handful of starts or maybe 10, 12 starts out of a pitcher, a few of those don't go your way. The offense doesn't show up or the bullpen blows the lead. And, you know, there's one great pitching performance that you just paid a lot for in talent. You didn't get a win out of it. So, whereas your hitter's going to be in that lineup every day contributing. So, you know, I think trading hitting for pitching, but also just trading, you know, contributing major league. It was a big surprise to see these three trades go down. With contributing major leaguers, you know, starting everyday major leaguers being traded by teams that were contending and trying to contend, yet dealing away some key parts. That was surprising, and if it doesn't work out, I don't think we probably won't see similar moves next year.
MLB writer for SI.com, Cliff Corcoran. Cliff, thanks for jumping on. Great stuff, and hopefully we'll do this again soon. Thanks for this.
Thanks for having me.
It's the Jeff Blair Show. It's George Russick. I'm Jeff Sam at Sportsnet 590. The Fan, it's 11:16. Well, the Washington Nationals are going for their 9th win in a row tonight against the Arizona Diamondbacks. Boy, they've got things going in a big, big way. Their radio voice is Charlie Slows, and he joins us on Sportsnet 590, The Fan. Charlie, to what do we attribute this winning streak for the Washington Nationals?
Well, some really good fortune, things going their way, key hits at key times, overcoming leads lost when your bullpen's a little tired, taking advantage of some teams that are not clicking on all cylinders. I guess the planet's just aligning right now, and the Nationals have battled injuries all year and always seem to have someone out of the lineup, and they're succeeding anyway. Earlier when they'd play the Atlanta Braves and lose the majority of the games to the Braves, but still have increased their lead since dropping 2 of 3 to the Braves earlier in the month. So this winning streak has enabled them to maintain a 6-game lead over the Braves, who were in a tailspin, but then have suddenly turned around and, as they have all year, gotten a little winning streak going again.
Charlie, look at the lineup last night. The first 7 hitters on this team, they all have an on base over 300. Just talk about the patience and the plate discipline of this team.
Well, Denard Span's had a great year. The media was questioning Matt Williams in the first month plus of the season. He was off to an okay start, not a great start, and said, well, maybe he's not the leadoff batter, and Matt Williams stuck by him. You had the comments of Bryce Harper when he was getting ready to come back in late June saying, well, Ryan Zimmerman's played great in left field. He should stay there, and Rendon should stay at third, and Danny Espinosa is the best defensive second baseman in all of baseball, and everybody knows I like center field best. Well, that didn't change anything from what Matt Williams and the club wanted to do. They put Zimmerman back at third, and he played great. He was hitting a ton until he pulled a hamstring in Colorado in late July. And Harper was in left, and Span has played Gold Glove caliber center, has been one of the best offensive players in baseball the past 2 months. So you have the combination of Span at the top getting on and showing more patience to take walks in addition to the hits that he's getting, and Rendon, who's terrific wherever you put him, but ideally suited to bat behind Span, and Jason Worth is the perfect guy to have when your first two batters have seen a lot of pitches, and he's looking at that from the on-deck circle, and he sees everything the pitcher's thrown. And then, you know, Adam LaRoche is a streaky hitter who didn't have a good July. He hit 159, but he's tore it hot here in August, and he lost 40 points off his average in July, and he's put half that back on already in August, and might be a Player of the Month candidate himself for August after Jason Worth won the NL Player of the Month award for July. They just went out and signed Nate Sheerholz, who's going to give them in a few days after some games at AAA, a left-handed bat off the bench that they really haven't had. Nate McLouth is now out for the year. He's going to have surgery tomorrow for a torn labrum in his right shoulder.
Ian Desmond, the leader in home runs and RBIs for the Washington Nationals.
I didn't even mention him, right?
Yeah, I just thought there was always one of those players, it seemed really this year, that just doesn't get talked about enough.
Doesn't hit for a high average. At least he's not this year.
251. Yeah.
He's right around. He's been down as low as in the, you know, low 230s at one point. But you know, he started the year batting sixth and seventh with Zimmerman out. Now he's in the number five spot. There's always men on base in front of him, it seems, and a chance to drive in runs. And even though he may not hit for average, he knows how to get the ball out of the infield when you have men in scoring position, whether last night he had a hit to left field to drive in two, a hit to right field to drive in two, and he had a big night at the plate. So, you know, Bryce Harper really hasn't done a whole lot since he's been back. He's really fighting his hitting mechanics. He's been batting behind Desmond. Seven has either been Wilson Ramos or Asdrubal Cabrera, who was their other trade deadline pickup to help fill the gap with Ryan Zimmerman out and Danny Espinosa just not able to hit from the left side of the plate as a switch hitter. Pretty good pickup right there. And then they added Matt Thornton, which stunned us. I know the Yankees signed him to a two-year deal for what a lot of people thought was a lot of money. The Nationals were interested in him in the offseason but weren't looking to sign him for 2 years. Now they get him for the rest of this year and next year and add a left-handed reliever who throws 95 to 97, switching leads to the National League where most haven't seen him. That's a great weapon to add to the bullpen.
Charlie, I'm sure one interview doesn't go by without talking more about one Bryce Harper, but do you find sometimes that he gets in his own way and that he's not just let the talent take over?
Probably so. Whether it was the comments that he made, whether they were inadvertent, they kind of blew up on him, or whether they were calculated, I really don't know, but I've never talked to him about them because it's just not something you'd approach him about after it was such a big firestorm after that, and that thing was kind of taken care of inside the clubhouse the way it's supposed to be. The other night, he singles to right field, takes a turnaround first. He's looking at the right fielder, gives him a little head fake like he's going to go to second and is hoping that the right fielder throws behind him. You know, like you see in Little League, a guy around first really hard and they'll throw behind him, and as that throw is going behind him to first, you keep running for second. Well, that didn't work. They threw ahead of him to second, and he got caught in a rundown. I mean, so a lot of the things that he's done aggressively on the base pass when he, you know, first came to the big leagues, you know, are not going to fool anybody anymore. So sometimes that over-aggressiveness or trying to throw behind a runner and they pull that play on you because they know that you will, if they take a big turnaround first, you will throw behind them from the outfield. They kind of turn the play around on him. But, you know, if you think about a few years back when teams first started with overshifts, and I remember the Nationals playing the Phillies, and Jimmy Rollins would be at first, and they'd put three men on the right side, and the third baseman straight up the middle of the diamond, and Jimmy Rollins would be on first and take off to steal and never slide, just keep running around second because nobody was covering third. Well, after that happens once or twice, every team leaves a guy on the left side of the infield knowing that a fast runner who steals a base could do that to you. Mm. And so that doesn't work anymore.
You know, it often gets forgotten that Bryce Harper is just going to be 22 this year. It just right. feels like there are so many expectations that are put on the, like you talk about Johnny Manziel with the Cleveland Browns, or something we're going to do later on in the hour. And there's a piece in the Washington Post asking, is Johnny Manziel the Bryce Harper of the NFL? It just seems like in sports nowadays, whenever you get these very gifted athletes that come into a league and play in a game with adults that are watched by adults, that so much is expected of these guys in their very early 20s to be mature and to do everything the right way. These guys are going to make mistakes, especially when along the way they're not tasting a failure, that they've, the rise has been such that they don't fail often or at all the whole way up, and they're surrounded by yes guys. It doesn't surprise me that Bryce Harper is going to make a mistake every once in a while on the field or off. This is part of the growing pains of having a player that young and that talented on your roster.
Right, and you know, guys that come, and you know, for him, 1 year in a Woodbat College League, playing for the University of Southern Nevada there, College of Southern Nevada, when he would have been a high school senior. And then after that season, he's drafted into the pros and has very limited time in the minor leagues. And you could say the same for Steven Strasburg, although he was a little bit older after 3 years at San Diego State being drafted and having a limited amount of time in the minor leagues as well. learning at this level, and making mistakes, trying to learn about himself, trying to, you know, make adjustments, trying not to show displeasure on the mound, body language, all sorts of things that you get away with at lower levels that certainly are not going to work when you're amongst the best at what they do in the major leagues. So, yeah, I mean, everybody is Clint Hurdle of the Pirates, I thought was a great line. We were talking with him earlier in the year about Gregory Polanco having limited amount of time in the minor leagues and all of that. And he said, yeah, well, there's an HOV lane now for guys who can play.
Yeah.
And they don't get 500 to 1,000 at-bats in the minor leagues anymore like they did years ago before baseball expanded. There's demand for talent, certainly. Pitching is rushed through the minor leagues. College players now are being drafted more and more because they're going to get to the big leagues quicker than your high school draft pick outside of a guy like Bryce Harper that, you know, they're normally going to take 4, 5, 6 years maybe to make it to the major leagues.
Charlie, a lot of eyebrows were raised a few years ago when the Nationals opened up the bank and signed Jason Wirth, but all in all, it hasn't been that bad of a signing, has it?
Well, you know, at the time, it seemed like a big amount of money, and then, you know, the Red Sox were interested in him, turned around and gave Carl Crawford more money. And so how that was looked upon, because Crawford was injured, kind of failed miserably in Boston with that big contract. But, you know, Jason Wirth didn't have a good first year with the Nationals, suffered some injuries, had that fractured wrist in 2012. But his presence now that this team is good, having been a guy who's played on a winner, he's 35 years old, he's been through all kinds of adversity, he's great for the young players, he's great in the clubhouse, sees so many pitches at the plate, all the things that you, all the reasons you signed him for now come to fruition. When you signed him, you weren't a real competitive club yet ready at that point. But now all the reasons you signed him for become even more valuable now that you are a contending team.
You know, looking at the pitching staff and seeing the team leader in wins is Doug Fister, and that was a player that when dealt and ending up with the Washington Nationals out of Detroit that many here in Toronto went, oh, we need starting pitching. What about that guy? That guy would have been great here with the Toronto Blue Jays. And seeing Fister in the season that he's had with the Nationals, how surprised are you to see those kind of results out of Fister, who was a pitcher that was just fine with the Detroit Tigers?
I'm really not surprised at all when you see the way he goes about his business, the way he prepares. Unfortunately, he got hurt in spring training, then recovering from one injury, injured himself in a different way and missed the first 5-6 weeks of the season. But he's been terrific. Great at fielding his position. He's a leader on the field. He works amazingly quick, keeping everybody on their toes, which means more times than not you're going to get great defense behind him when he's pitching. And he's, I think he's everything and more that they hoped he could be, a veteran guy who's been through postseason, who's pitched in a World Series, add an element to this pitching staff that they did not have. And, you know, I think he's become a leader on this team, certainly the pitching staff, the way he goes about it and the way guys are looking up to him now. I think he's added a tremendous amount. It's interesting because when I talked to Mike Rizzo, those conversations that started with Dave Dombrowski to make that deal were not about Doug Fister. They were about Max Scherzer, who Detroit was more interested in trading because they didn't think they were going to be able to sign him. And Mike Rizzo really had his eye on Doug Fister all along.
He is the radio play-by-play voice of the Washington Nationals, Charlie Slows. Charlie, thanks for doing this. Thanks for the natitude.
Hey, long time no took. Good to talk to you, man.
Yeah, thank you, Charlie. And I sat next to Charlie many, many games when he was voicing games for the Tampa Bay Rays. And it was the dog days of the Tampa Bay Rays. Where it was just
when they were
really
the devil
tough.
Rays.
They were terrible. And I would sit with him. I was his engineer, and I would sit with him in these Rays Blue Jay games in September that meant nothing, you know. But the guy gives it his all, and he's a very good broadcaster. And I'm glad things are working out with the Washington Nationals, because that's what you want to do as a broadcaster. If you're calling games for a team, you want to get into the playoffs and have a little fun there too. So good for Charlie Slows.
You think Jerry Howard's feeling that too?
Right now. No, it's hard to feel positive.
It's been 20 years since I've called a playoff game here, boys. Let's get things going.
Yeah, it's been a while.
Yep.
Jerry wants to have some fun in October.
This is true.
Do it for Jerry. Maybe that should be his slogan. Just try to get that.
Or do you think he's secretly pumping his fist? He's like, just, he has the countdown clock on.
Nah.
36 more games. I peace out.
Nah, I think.
Attaboy, Blue Jays. You just keep losing those games. I'm peacing out. Going to coach my college, the high school basketball team.
I think by mid-November, he's chomping at the bit to get to Dunedin and start calling spring training games, to be honest with you. So that's what I think. As we continue this hour, I made the comparison of Bryce Harper and Johnny Manziel. Well, I didn't. The Washington Post did. But don't you think that expectations are too high with these young kids? I'm not saying it's forgiving. Like the Manziel flipping the bird to the Washington Football Club the other night. Of course, that's not the right thing to do. That was wrong. You shouldn't have done that. That was stupid,
Jeff,
and immature. But what do you expect? These are kids.
Why do we live in this era now that we forget that it takes time to develop young quarterbacks in the NFL?
Yeah.
Like these guys like Russell Wilson and Colin Kaepernick and RG3 and Andrew Luck, all these guys have spoiled us coming right into the league and doing exceptionally well. Do you remember the times where Eli Manning and Peyton Manning taking all their lumps as starting quarterbacks? Tom Brady was behind Drew Bledsoe for how many years? That was the norm in the NFL, where young quarterbacks took time to develop and grow into the pros that they are. Now we're in this stage that we think all these guys straight from college should just be on the field and dominate. It just doesn't work that way.
Well,
these guys were maybe the anomaly who've been around the last few years.
Right, but in the case of Harper and Johnny Football, or Johnny Backup, as he's going to be known for maybe just a couple of weeks, the expectations for these guys, and as we talked with Charlie about, these kids do not have failure throughout because they're so good. They're so talented. They have yes guys all around them. And they don't taste and experience any failure. They get to the highest level of their sport. They experience some failure, some adversity, and then they have to be mature enough to be able to withstand that sort of thing. It doesn't always happen. I'm not saying it's right. I'm not saying that Johnny Manziel had every right to flip the bird to the Washington Football Club just for that. No, he shouldn't have done that. He shouldn't have done that. But to have these expectations of these guys, to think that they're going to do everything right, I think is wrong on behalf of the fans. Again, not to say that you could excuse that type of behavior, but this guy's been in the league for 15 minutes. Everybody's been loving this guy. Everybody's been talking about him before he throws a pass that he should be a starting quarterback in the NFL. And you're right that it does take time to do that in many cases. But they've been giving this guy the starting job right from the get-go. He knows that jerseys are being sold across the country, that everybody has his name on their backs. You get an ego with that sort of thing, and every once in a while that's going to get to you.
You know what, Sam? Though, when it comes to him, I like the ego. I like that he came out in his pro day and he got geared up completely. The first guy to wear all his equipment in pro day. I want my quarterback to have that attitude.
So every once in a while, you're going to get
that. I'm okay with it.
I mean, not with that.
Win.
Not with that specifically.
Right.
Flipping
but again,
the bird.
But again, we blow that way out of proportion.
But for
too.
The big picture of what you're getting, that's what you're... I'm not saying that, but that's what you're saying. Like, the big picture that you're going to get out of Johnny Manziel, you're willing to take those lumps in that he's going to make those kind of mistakes every once in a while.
Sure, and as long as he wins. And what that gesture just pales in comparison to what is said on the actual field itself. So I think we just need to slow our roll a little bit about him flipping the bird. It's okay. But just win. And I want my quarterback to have that confidence that I want to be the guy to take that football.
Yeah,
I want to be the guy
confidence.
To fit that.
But
sure,
that's
it is.
Not
it, it's part
that's
and parcel.
Not confidence. He's flipping the bird to the other football team because they've
I'm
gotten
just,
to
I'm
him.
I'm just not saying the. I'm just saying as a whole what he brings. That attitude. I like that attitude. I'm not just focusing on one event, him flipping the bird to the Washington sideline. That's fine. But I'm saying the Johnny Football aura around him, the confidence that, I should have went higher in the draft. Yeah, I should have went ahead of Blake Bortles. I like that kind of stuff. I want that from my quarterback. I want him to be the guy to take that football and lead us down the drive to win the game for the Cleveland Browns.
And he has.
If you're a Cleveland Browns fan, the doormat of the NFL in that division, watching the Ravens and the Steelers, and God forbid the Bengals come in and kick your ass asked two times a year. It's about time that maybe this guy is the X factor. And I don't mind the attitude that surrounds Johnny Football.
Well,
and we're also, gotta have ego. You think Peyton doesn't have ego? You don't think Tom Brady's a dick? These guys are fantastic athletes. You want that attitude, especially in such a critical position quarterback.
You want to have ego, but you got to channel it in the right way. And Johnny Football did not do that the other night. But for anybody that's out there that says, oh, this guy should have known better. No, he doesn't know better. He's a kid.
Right.
He's a kid. He doesn't know any better.
It all comes down to winning, too. Like, all this stuff surrounding, if he wins.
And he was horrible the other night. Horrible.
Right.
But so was Hoyer, and so was everybody that played in front of
him. Right.
And now, a day late, because they said, the Browns said that it was yesterday, that the Tuesday they were looking at, that they were going to name their starting quarterback. They didn't do it yesterday, but they did it this morning, and they went with Hoyer. They went with the veteran, and I think they were begging.
The veteran of a handful of starts.
They were begging that Johnny Manziel would have showed something to this point where they said, well, we got to go with him. He didn't. He didn't show anything. But neither did Hoyer, neither did anybody else
Mike Pettine, a new head coach of the Browns, you got to go safe a little bit. And Hoyer, before he got hurt, he was doing exceptionally well for the Browns.
I'm fine with
it. So it's a can't lose for Mike Pettine, and that's the smart decision.
Well, maybe it's a can't win.
Why on earth? Do you start Johnny Football when he can be quote unquote the savior? Let him be. You know, the clipboard dude. Hey, hold the clipboard and see how the NFL game is played a little bit.
A young guy, you know, if we're talking football, basketball, hockey, whatever, doesn't matter. I always look at a young guy and say I don't want to give him that job until he earns it. That's what I like to do. And if you've got a veteran like Hoyer that you can go with just at least to buy you some time before Johnny Manziel can, you know, spend some time in the National Football League, spend some time with your club and kind of find himself a little bit. You know, when that time comes, and I'm saying when, not if, but when that time comes, fine. Then he could start when that time does come. But for right now, as we're standing right now, waiting for the season to start, about halfway through the preseason, I'm fine with starting the veteran.
And I'm not saying that Hoyer is the answer. The guy's had a handful of starts in the NFL.
Well, maybe right now he's the answer.
A cup of coffee with the Arizona Cardinals before he joins the Cleveland Browns. So by no means is the leash long on a guy like Brian Hoyer. And if he struggles, definitely you're going to see some Johnny Football action.
Oh, boy. Here comes the money. He struggles in the first drive of the season. First drive of the season. They'll be begging, the fans will, for Johnny Manziel. Daryl Ryder, Browns beat writer or beat reporter for 92.3, The Fan in Cleveland, is going to join us to talk about that decision. It's Hoyer getting the starting job over Manziel. It's George Russick. I'm Jeff Sam. It's the Jeff Blair Show on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Prices like no other, from a club like no other, The Fan Club. Log on to sportsnet590.ca.
Just a few minutes left to go in the Jeff Blair Show with George Russick. I'm Jeff Sambit, Sportsnet 590, The Fan. Blair and Barker will have Baseball Central. Not only can you listen to it right here, but also be able to watch it on Sportsnet. George, quick question for you. Blue Jays beat the Brewers today. If that's going to happen this afternoon, a game we'll have for you. Again, Sportsnet 590, The Fan. You can watch it on Sportsnet 210, first pitch. If the Blue Jays were to win this afternoon, you feeling a bit better about them or still feel the same?
3.5 games looks a hell of a lot better than 4.5 games, doesn't it?
Yes.
And heading into a gigantic homestand?
Mm-hmm. And they'll have a day off.
Glass half full.
All right.
But it just goes to show how day-to-day, game-to-game we are with the Toronto Blue Jays. They win. Oh, they're back in it. They lose. The next game, season's over.
I'll watch / listen to the game today and figure out how I feel later on.
Just quickly, to hit that magical win total, Blue Jays got to go 26-10 the rest of the season.
No problem. They went 25-12 in a stretch between, May something and June something.
Sure, but that's not 26-10. That's 7-22 ball.
No problem. That can be done.
It's early.
Yeah, it's early. Daryl Ryder, Browns beat reporter, 92.3 The Fan in Cleveland, joining us on Sportsnet 590. The Fan, as Brian Hoyer has been named the week one quarterback, starting quarterback for the Browns over Johnny Manziel. How does this quote, Daryl, grab you by Mike Pettine, the coach of the Cleveland Browns, talking about Hoyer saying he was the clear leader from the beginning. We've maintained all along that if it was close, I would prefer to go with the more experienced player. Brian has done a great job in the meeting rooms and with his teammates on the practice field and in the locker room. But the beginning of that quote, he was the clear leader from the beginning. Did you get that feeling out of the Cleveland Browns about their quarterbacks?
Yeah, I really did, especially over the last week or so, even though, they went ahead and continued with this competition. Look, Brian Hoyer received the first team reps for the first week of training camp. They had 16 total practices, and he got the exclusive reps with the ones 14 times. He also started both preseason games, so it stood to reason that Brian Hoyer was going to be named the starting quarterback, barring some unbelievable performance from Johnny Manziel, which, quite frankly, we never saw in camp, and we certainly didn't see in those first two preseason games.
But, Darryl, should we just slow our roll a little bit on a guy like Brian Hoyer, who had a cup of coffee with the Cardinals and essentially has made just a handful of starts for the Cleveland Browns? Is his leash short with the Browns this season?
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think Brian has to play well, especially with the bye week being as early as it is this season. They'll have time to reset things after the third game. They've got three tough games right out of the gate. They travel to Pittsburgh in week one. They come home to host the New Orleans Saints and then Baltimore Ravens before that bye week. So I think Brian Hoyer is getting a three-week audition here to show that he can be a starting quarterback in the NFL. It also buys the Browns one extra month to prepare Johnny Manziel. Actually, it's more than a month, about a month and a half from now. And look, Johnny Manziel clearly, while he might be leading the world in jersey sales and everybody's anxious to see him play, he's not ready to play. He showed that Monday night. Now, that's not to say that Brian Hoyer in the preseason has shown that he's ready to be a starting quarterback in the league, because he's not played well, and Brian will tell you that. But Manziel and the gesture in the third quarter, it just shows his immaturity and that he's not ready, both from a mental standpoint as well as a physical standpoint, to lead this football team. So I think it's the logical choice to name Hoyer the starter, but he will be on a short leash, in my opinion.
Was Johnny Manziel's middle finger the deciding factor here?
No, I don't think it was the deciding factor, but I do believe it was a factor, because it goes to maturity and it goes to the ability to lead as well as tune out. I mean, look, we've all been in locker rooms and heard some things, and you can only imagine the type of stuff based on his social media presence and the tabloids and that. You can only imagine some of the stuff that is going to be said to him. And so if you're going to react in that manner because the Redskins sideline tells you, hey, you're not in college anymore, kid, what are you going to do when they bring up some other things? So I do think it was a factor. I do believe it was the deciding factor. But, a gesture like that, his first time in prime time, it's not going to be remembered for him being the first Browns quarterback to finally get the Browns into the end zone. It's going to be that gesture. That's what people are going to remember.
Darryl, will either Hoyer or Manziel have Josh Gordon as a target, at least after the bye week this season?
You know, I wish I could give you an answer there, but nobody knows. And I don't even think that the arbitrator knows at this point whether or not Josh Gordon's going to be on the field. I'll say this. The fact that this process is taking so long, and I really hesitate to read into anything, especially in this particular situation. But I do think that the fact that it's taking this long to sift through all the evidence and the testimony and all those type of things, I have to think that has to be a positive for this situation, that there's actually something for this arbitrator to consider. Now, the other part of this is the Ray Rice suspension, the fact he only got two games and he committed assault against a woman. And then you've got a guy that may or may not have failed a marijuana test, and he will be gone for a year. Even though that's spelled out in the collective bargaining agreement, the fan reaction is not going to be very positive. So I think the longer this takes, maybe it means good things for Josh Gordon. But I will say this, Mike Pettine has not liked what he's seen from Gordon in the last week or so, especially on Monday night in the effort department.
And Darryl Ryder, Browns beat reporter, 92.3 The Fan in Cleveland. Thank you, Darryl.
You got it, guys.
And thanks to you for listening, calling, texting, tweeting. That guy who emailed. Follow us on Twitter at RusticSN590.
He's getting Jeff creepy. Sandman590. He's getting a little creepy.
He is starting. I think he's watching us. Back tomorrow morning. We're not on television. Back tomorrow morning for another edition of the Jeff Blair Show at 9 a.m. Baseball Central. Blair and Barker next on Sportsnet 590. The fan you can watch on Sportsnet. And happy 66th birthday, Robert Plant.